Good evening. Welcome behind the news for August 4, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And first segment, a little off the beaten track, we will be talking to Periel Aschenbrand, who is an author and fashion designer, political fashion designer, author of a new book called The Only Bush I Trust Is My Own. And she's got some clothing with that and other political themes. So we'll talk about fashion and politics and whatever else comes up. Well, she's not here yet, so I hope she does materialize. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with Michael Yates, who's one of the editors of the magazine Monthly Review, about several things. The new webzine that MR has launched, MR itself as an ongoing enterprise. And also, Michael has been traveling around the United States since taking early retirement a few years ago. And I've been meaning to get him to talk about his observations as a political economist traveling through the United States right now, what he sees and how it all strikes him. He's in, I believe, Flagstaff, Arizona now. Spent quite some time in Miami. Spent some time here, too, in New York City. And it'll be interesting to hear his reflections on the USA. And since he's also something of an authority on labor issues, maybe going to talk about what's going on with the AFL-CIO. Before we get to the headlines, last week's interview with Chip Brule attracted some fairly hostile commentary. My email box was filled. I've got a couple of gracious notes of appreciation, but most of it was fairly hostile and vituperative. And to the fellow who keeps calling and leaving messages in my voicemail, wondering why I'm not calling him back. It's the way to elicit a callback is not to describe a show as miserable and outrageous and terrible and disgusting. So if you're listening, consider this my answer to you. And I just heard the name Eric Hufschmidt in the community bulletin board just before coming on here. He is the producer of the video, what is it called, Painful Questions? Deceptions, Painful Deceptions. I urge everyone to pay a visit to his website, erichufschmid.net, erichufschmid.net, where you can read about how there weren't enough ovens at Auschwitz to produce the death count that has been attributed to the Holocaust, how it couldn't have been a death camp if Anne Frank was transferred from there to Bergen-Belsen, how the Western Hemisphere is populated by white trash, brown trash, and black trash, how the United States needs an elite backed by a military to take over and end this democracy because the mass of people are not fit to rule, and how no one actually landed on the moon. The Apollo moon program was a hoax. So check out Eric Hufschmidt's work and see if that casts his 9/11 theorizing in a different kind of light. It's it strikes me as vile, hateful, and insane stuff, but perhaps my definitions of those things are not the same as the audience's. Back to regularly scheduled programming now. Some words about the economic headlines. First of all, the American consumer set some kind of record in June, achieving a savings rate of zero. That has happened only, well, there's one month in October 2001 where that happened before, but that seems to be a statistical anomaly. The surrounding months were not that low. During the early years of the 1930s depression, the savings rate was negative because people had to stay alive, and so they were consuming more than their income. That happens in severe depressions. But for a country to have a 0% savings rate in what's supposed to be a prosperous time is extremely strange, and I would say kind of disregarding the future. It means that the United States as a whole is living way beyond its means, borrowing very, very heavily to maintain an extreme level of consumption. The month of June, for example, income was up 0.5%, consumption up 0.8%. So, and this has been fairly consistent, that consumption has been outstripping income. The savings rate just, what, like 8 months ago, 1.3% of income. December, 4.4% of after-tax income, now zero. It's been trending down for a considerable length of time. It was about 8% of people were saving, in the aggregate, about 8% of their after-tax income in the 1980s. That fell to 4% in the 1990s, and it is now at zero, a remarkable development in the world of economics. Sure enough, people have been buying stuff like crazy, and partly because of incentives. The auto industry has been cutting prices like crazy to move inventory out of their lots. Americans bought almost 21 million cars and trucks at an annual, that's an annualized rate. We haven't seen that kind of rate of vehicle buying since 1986, but this is a remarkable thing, extremely strong pace of car and SUV purchasing, and of course all that on credit, and people very often buying new cars before they even paid off the loan on the old one, and that strikes me as imprudent, but maybe I'm just being old-fashioned. It was also reported that chain store sales, that is sales of large department stores and other kinds of chains, up 3.6% in the month of July from the previous July. That's a little weaker than June, but still quite a strong result. And July, not a big month in the retail calendar, but still Americans buying stuff with abandon. That despite the fact that consumer confidence, people are telling pollsters that they're not very happy with their own state of their own finances or the state of the national economy. The ABC Washington Post Consumer Comfort Index, which comes out every week, off 4 points last week to a rather mediocre level of minus 11. And it had staged a recovery in the previous couple of weeks, but now it's completely reversed that recovery. Tomorrow we're going to get the monthly employment report. We'll see how many new jobs the United States economy created. What's happened with the unemployment rate? I'm expecting a kind of moderate growth of about 150,000-200,000 jobs. Nothing really spectacular. We're still have a great jobs deficit in the country. Wage growth very weak, but despite all that, people buying stuff like crazy and buying it on credit. And then finally, a market research firm, Anholt GMI, put out a study earlier this week in which they did a poll worldwide and asked people how they rated various countries, 25 countries, as if they were brands. We certainly reached a certain state of consciousness of countries are seen as brands, but the results are nonetheless fairly interesting. The United States now ranked 11th out of 25, the Financial Times, in reporting on this study in its August 1st edition, said this findings will add to concerns that anti-Americanism is hurting companies whose products are considered to be distinctly American. Things like Starbucks and Marlboro have been suffering sales declines abroad because they're seen as quintessentially American. And a good bit of this is a reaction to American foreign policy. But what is loosely called the business community does not seem to have expressed any discontent about this fact to the president and his administration, which is largely responsible for this. The author of the survey, Simon Anholt, says the U.S. is recognized as a leading place to do business, but its governance, its cultural heritage, and its people are no longer widely respected or admired by the world. The president of a group called Business for Diplomatic Action, a group dedicated to improving our image overseas, says the U.S. government is not a credible messenger anymore, so they want to privatize the rebuilding of the American image, which seems to me more of the same disease, not much of a cure for one. But the U.S., as I said, ranking 11th out of the 25 countries rated, lacking in wisdom, intelligence, and integrity. We ranked last in cultural heritage among the 25 countries. Although the FT points out at the end of their story that the world takes a dim view of the U.S. people will surprise most Americans themselves, the study's American respondents consistently place the U.S. at the top of all six categories polled. So we think the world of ourselves, but the world doesn't think the same of us. So let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with Periel Aschenbrandt.
It's the only way. Bless your dress, you're out of style, your brainwashed victim for
that an excerpt from Chicks on Speed song from a few years ago, Fashion Rules. You got to follow the rules, you got to break the rules. It seems to be the contradictory rules of fashion. Welcome to the WBAI, Periel Aschenbrand. I should say you have a design firm called Body as Billboard.
Yes.
On the web at bodyasbillboard.com,
correct,
all one word.
Mm-hmm.
And a new book out, also The Only Bush I Trust Is My Own. So which is it, breaking rules or following rules? What's fashion really about?
Well, I don't know what fashion is about, but I can say that I'm certainly not about following the rules. So maybe if that translates over into the shirts that I make, I think that they're certainly not following the rules.
Well, you attract a lot of attention when at the Republican convention you were parading around with a T-shirt that said, "The only Bush I trust is my own." Tell us how the backstory of that T-shirt.
Well, the backstory of that T-shirt was that I was teaching contemporary philosophy, to high school students on a summer arts program. And I was showing them the work of people like Chomsky, bell hooks, James Baldwin, the Guerrilla Girls. And I had them make political billboards for their final projects and matching shirts. And I sort of scurried off and made myself a shirt that said, "The only Bush I trust is my own," which seemed to just explode. I mean, certainly it wasn't making T-shirts for anybody else until people started seeing that shirt, and then I was.
So where did you display it? Where was it seen? Where were you discovered?
On me.
Just walking around
town?
Yeah,
I mean, I was, you know, in a store in L.A., actually, and the owner said, "Oh, where did you get that shirt?" And I was actually working on my book at the time, and I was like, "Oh, yeah, I made it." We have to have those for our store. So I was, like, covered in ink for about 3 months, like, sort of hand-screening these shirts, and girls were returning them. They were saying the ink was coming off. I said, "Well, this is, you know, cultural criticism. It's pop art. You know, I can't help you."
Some problems with quality control at the beginning.
Yeah.
So have you actually converted this little prank, this little gesture into an actual business now? You're running a fashion enterprise?
I don't know if I would go so far as to say that I'm running a fashion enterprise, but I did start a line of T-shirts, Body as Billboard, with various socially conscious slogans on them.
And I was interested how, in reading the book, which is very entertaining. It's a
thank you very
witty,
much.
Entertaining, you. Charming book. But you realize that we can't use the vulgar word on the radio, but the female breast is a very valuable piece of real estate in a lot of ways.
Yes, of course I realize that.
Could you tell us the story of that discovery?
Well, I'd been writing for a long time, working on various projects, and suddenly when the words were written across my chest, let's say, on this valuable piece of real estate, people were very interested in my message, let's say, in what I had to say. So it sort of grew from there. It seemed a very effective way to try and affect some sort of awareness.
And so what other slogans are you trading in now?
Well, I designed a shirt for Alicia Keys' AIDS organization called Keep a Child Alive. And the shirt's a drug dealer on the front, and a buck a day buys the drugs to keep a child alive on the back. And all of those drugs go to, the money from the shirts go to buy drugs for children and families with HIV AIDS in Africa. So that's a wild shirt to wear out. You wear a shirt out that says drug dealer before people see the back.
Hey, what kind of reactions do you get?
Well, late one night I was wearing it and some guy was drunk and stumbled up to me and said, "I've been looking for you all night."
He must have been very disappointed when
yes,
he found out
he was.
The real story.
He was. I said, "I don't think these are the kinds of drugs you're looking for."
I suppose this, the philosophical question is, will this really change anything? Is it going to wake up people's consciousness? Are you going to get them to do something? Will the effect of this last beyond the aha moment of amusement or a shock?
I think that certainly there is shock value to it. I don't think that people are really necessarily used to seeing socially aware messages or consciousness in fashion like that. But I do think that there's something there beyond just the aha moment, because in the culture that we live in, I think it's very particular to this culture that something like that could actually be effective. that suddenly people, or at least the girls who buy my shirts, are aware of what they're supporting, where their money's going. They know where it's made. I mean, I think people generally don't really think about that in this country, that your shirt was made by a 12-year-old girl in Indonesia who's been working for 18 hours. And that the decisions that you make
Is that where you get the shirts that the messages are silk-screened onto?
From a factory in Indonesia?
Yeah.
No, they're sweatshop-free, my shirts. Okay. I get them from a sweatshop-free, emphatic sweatshop-free company called American Apparel. That's where I buy my blanks from.
American Apparel.
I'm saying other companies, not my
right,
company.
Yes, yes. Well, I think people are kind of dimly aware that their clothes are made under often appalling circumstances, but they don't really know what to do about it. There are some exceptions here and there, but it's not easy to find a shirt that isn't got a lot of blood, sweat, and tears behind it.
Well, you have to look for it. I mean, you also have to, like, really know that, you know, if you're making a decision to walk around with a slogan or an insignia, you're supporting that company and you're supporting the practices of that company. I mean, they should be paying you to do advertising for them, not the other way around.
Yeah, I mean, well, years ago, Alexander Coburn wrote in a column that he refused to give money to Channel 13 in one of their pledge drives because he didn't want to become an ambulant billboard for them and get their tote bag or their T-shirt or whatever. But most people seem pleased, even proud, to be walking around with somebody else's logo.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the companies are spending billions of dollars in advertising. You know, you want to wear this. It's cool. I think the shirts that I make are more interesting than wearing a shirt that says, you know, Idaho, no Udaho, or I'm with stupid, or, you know, Mrs. Timberlake, you know, pick your T-shirt. There are a lot of them out there.
Yeah, there's certainly no shortage of those. Well, you write about the experience of teaching to what sound like a fairly well-off group of girls, all of them, teenage girls?
No, no, boys and girls.
How did they react to your attempt to raise political consciousness?
I think initially some of them were really kind of shocked, to be honest with you. I mean, I think it really had never even crossed their mind that by going into someplace like Starbucks that they even had the option to go down the block and that there is an independent coffee shop there. I mean, I those things aren't in plain view explained to kids, you know, that if you shop here, you're making a decision to support something, and often it's something odious. I think a lot of them felt very empowered, actually.
Did you have to overcome some sort of perception of dorkiness, that sort of political?
No, because I'm not really so dorky, so I have that going for me.
I'm speaking with Periel Aschenbrand, who is a T-shirt designer and author of a book called The Only Bush I Trust Is My Own, which is just out from Torture Penguin Books. You've also got a plan coming up, I see, on your website, the Knockout Project. What's that about?
That's the attempt to redefine the word knockout, as opposed to being an airhead, that it's actually an individual, a woman, let's say, who's aware of what's going on globally and nationally in our community. And so on the back of the shirt, it says Stop Violence Against Women.
How can people stop violence against women?
Well, first of all, I think they have to know what's going on. Part of the proceeds of those shirts are being donated to an organization that's dedicated to that, that they meet women in hospitals who have been raped. I think that it's something that's sort of swept under the carpet. Nobody really likes to talk about those kinds of things. It's a little bit ugly. I mean, I think it needs to be introduced into the conversation, into the dialogue.
Now, on the cover of your book, you are largely naked except for some strategic coverings here.
And, fig leaf.
Has a fig leaf holding an apple in best
it's
Eve.
It's a garden
Eve
of
the Temptress,
Eden, yes.
Eve the Temptress fashion. Some of the messages on your T-shirts are suggestive, shall we say. Do you get any complaints from some of our more earnest or serious feminists or liberals who find this somehow playing with the very tools of advertising and the demeaning images of women that feminists are supposed to be opposed to?
I don't know. I think that in the poster that I did, 100 Reasons Not to Vote for Bush, which were 100 photographs of 100 women wearing the only Bush I trust is my own tank top, I had some feminists feature there, like Gloria Steinem and the Guerrilla Girls, and so Susan Sarandon. I think I'm coming from a place and I'm being supported by people who understand the point of what I'm doing. I mean, there's certainly a sense of humor to it. And I am playing with advertising. I mean, that's precisely the point, that I'm not trying to sell a pair of shoes. I mean, even on my website as well, I say, make the shirts yourself. You know, this was never a business plan for me. I'm first and foremost a writer, you know. So it was really sort of socially motivated.
Well, feminism has an image problem among a lot of younger women that's frequently lamented by older feminists. Why do you think that is? I mean, for example, the teenagers you were teaching. Why is feminism such a loaded and unpleasantly loaded word for so many people?
I mean, because of the culture we live in. I mean, you're supposed to look like, you know, you've been airbrushed, and girls hate their bodies because we're bombarded with thousands of images, of unrealistic images, quite frankly. And they don't get those other things, you know. I mean, they're not encouraged to be a feminist by, you know, the TV, or, you know, they're not aware of the fact that, you know, there are millions of people in Africa who are dying of AIDS because of the pharmaceutical companies and these policies. I mean, they have, like, tabloids thrust at them, and, you know, MTV or whatever. So it's not hip. I think it's starting to change a little bit. I mean, I know that my kids who I work with are on the forefront of that movement.
And the book, the genre is a little strange. I've never read anything quite like it.
Well, thank you very much.
I mean, what is this, like, meant as a polemic, as a memoir, a mix of all these things? What was your intention in writing it?
I don't think that I had a genre necessarily picked out, but I think it's pretty straightforward and is meant as such, you know, full of irony and humor. And very conversational, I think. And I'm thrilled to hear that you've never read anything like it before.
I think the cover compares you to Holden Caulfield somewhere, doesn't it? Yes. Watch out, Caulfield. Watch out, Portnoy, Bukowski, and Candace Bushnell. That's an odd collection of parallels being drawn. But the cover copy, which of course you're not responsible for, says, if members of the Symbionese Liberation Army had carried Prada handbags, that's really not what you're about, are you?
Well, I think I'm certainly a victim of the culture that I decry, yes. I mean, I'm definitely involved in fashion. And are you looking to see if there's
yes,
a Prada handbag?
Yes, I was looking to see any brand names there. Is that a Louis Vuitton bag? There?
Yes.
Yes.
So actually, that was a gag present that a friend of mine bought me in Chinatown. So uh-huh. I will say that. But there's the Prada handbag behind it. You can't see the triangle.
Of course.
Now.
But Prada herself claims to have been quite a politically radical. Former student of political science. She says she's embarrassed to talk about her politics because most people think fashion is such a silly thing that no one will take her seriously. But wearing a Prada handbag can be a political act.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so.
You're doing a reading tonight at a Barnes & Noble, is it?
Barnes & Noble, Chelsea.
Could you give the details on that?
7 p.m., 21st and 6th.
And you'll be reading from the book?
I will probably be reading parts of the book.
But you're not wearing one of your T-shirts right now.
No, I'm not wearing one of my T-shirts right now. I'm not always wearing one of my T-shirts.
Not a billboard for yourself.
I am, just not right at the moment.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having
me. Periel Aschenbrand. Check out her website, bodyisbillboard.com, all one word, and the book, The Only Bush I Trust Is My Own, where I believe people can order T-shirts if they'd like.
Yes, not from the book, from the website.
Right.
Yes.
Right, from the website, not from the book. Yes. The book technology hasn't reached that stage
Not yet.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us. And let's take a break for a station ID. And we have Michael Yates around waiting for us. Okay. So we'll be joined by Michael Yates in a little bit.
Hi, this is Lloyd Price, and you're tuned to WBAI New York. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Oh, yeah.
A salon of the arts.
Live Mondays at 2 p.m.
With me, Janet Coleman, and you,
David Dozer.
The displaced playwright, featuring interviews with scintillating authors.
And provocative artistes.
And why not a Poison Arts Minute?
Because that's why.
On Cat Radio Cafe.
Hey, cats.
Stop clawing the furniture.
Get down.
And head for the radio.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Mondays at 2.
Hey, the cats drink coffee?
If it's brewed with fish.
And we're back here. I'm Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. And let's just take a little musical break and then bring on Michael Yates. And that little bit of the Mekon song, The Flame That Killed John Wayne, a church, a liquor store, an auto repair shop. That seems like a good bit of the American landscape. And I hope to talk about the American landscape with our next guest, Michael Yates, who has been traveling around the United States, and want to get his impressions of that. But first, I want to get him to talk about Monthly Review and its a new webzine. Welcome to Behind the News, Michael.
Hey, how you doing, Doug?
Very good. Thanks for joining us. So I hope most of the listeners know what Monthly Review is, but before we start talking about MR's new webzine, give us the little capsule summary of MR. What is it all about?
Well, Monthly Review is an independent socialist magazine that's been publishing continuously since May 1949, when Albert Einstein wrote the lead article, Why Socialism? And we've been going pretty strong ever since, publishing just about every prominent left-wing writer in the world, I would say, over the last 50 years. I've been associate editor of the magazine since 2001, and we're located offices in on West 27th Street in New York City, and that's sort of a brief capsule history. We've dealt with many issues, most prominently with labor movements, U.S. imperialism, the environment, that sort of thing, from an independent left-wing perspective, not affiliated with any political party or tendency or anything like that, always maintaining as much political independence as we can. We rely strictly on subscribers' generosity for our income, so we're independent in that way too.
And the writing is always quite clear and accessible. It doesn't require any specialist background or anything like that.
Well, one of the things that we do, I think, that probably a lot of magazines don't, is we take our editing seriously. And when we have a piece that we think has some good things to say but could be clearer, we do the editing in conjunction with the authors. And I don't think very many magazines do that. And I think that helps to add to the clarity. We write for a general audience. We don't like to have real technical types of, you know, academic articles, but, you know, at the same time, I think the articles are pretty sophisticated. So sophisticated and clear is a combination that's hard to beat.
No kidding. And I must say that Monthly Review, the magazine, and also the press, it publishes quite a number of books, including some really great classics, Monopoly Capital, Labor Monopoly Capital, Open Veins of Latin America, many Many great books published by MArt. The whole enterprise, I got to say, is one of the things that made me who I am today. So I'm always grateful for the existence of Monthly Review, and I hope other people discover it as well. Now, MR has entered the world of, well, it's not quite blogging, but you've got a webzine going. So tell us about the new MR zine.
Well, we started the new web magazine. It's mrzine.org, M-R-Z-I-N-E. And it's under the editorship of a Japanese woman by the name of Yoshia Furuhashi. I think you know her. She's been on your LBO talk list for some time. And we're all working along with her. And what we decided was is that we needed to have a web presence. And we started on Bastille Day, July the 14th, with our first issue, if that's what you call them. And we try to have daily content, different content every day. They're short articles, usually about 1,000 words or so, dealing with a wide variety of topics, probably a little bit wider even than what you might see in the magazine, and by a pretty good group of people so far. I think we've had short articles we've had poetry by Marge Piercy and Adrian Rich. We've had articles by Susie Day and Bernadine Dorn, Bill Fletcher, John Foster, Stan Goff, Samir Amin, a wide number of people. And I think it's pretty cleverly designed. And one of the neat things about it is there's a picture on it every day. And when you click on that picture, you kind of get a surprise. It links to some article or some other pictures or somebody's website or something like that. And what we're hoping is that we can attract a younger audience. A lot of the people that originally subscribed to Monthly Review are pretty old. They're alive at all. And we need to reach out to younger people, both in the United States and around the world. And I think we're going to have some music links on the website and film reviews and that sort of thing to make it popular among a wider segment of people. So what we're trying to do is with the webzine is to reach out to a wider audience, if at all possible. And, of course, like most such web enterprises, we hope we can use it for some fundraising, too, because magazines like Monthly Review are always short of money to do the kinds of things we want. And there aren't very many of us that do the work, and we're stretched pretty thin. So we're hoping to, you know, reach out and raise money through the webzine, too, in addition to having interesting and attractive content.
Yeah, I don't think anyone has really figured this out yet, but I was going to ask you, what's the economic model here? Because will it, as they say, cannibalize subscriptions to the magazine? Will it bring in subscriptions to the magazine?
Well, how
are you covering the expenses?
You're right. I mean, it's an experiment, and we're going to have to see what happens. We're thinking that we should be able to, if we reach a larger audience, we should be able to raise some money. And in addition, we're hoping that people will be attracted to the kinds of things they read there to refer back to the magazine and perhaps subscribe to that too. There's a certain risk involved there, and we're all aware of that. But we figure that you almost have to enter the web world these days to survive and get your message out there. So many people out there presenting messages, and the print media is probably not as popular as it used to be. So what we're hoping is to raise money and make the webzine a separate enterprise, but also to tie it as closely to the magazine and press as we can and attract new readers to the magazine and to the press. And we're going to have to see how that works out.
And the MR zine is 3 weeks old today, so how are you pleased with this 3 week old?
Well, we're pretty pleased. We've seen a pretty big increase. You know, Monthly Review itself has a website, and we've seen a pretty big increase in the number of hits that we get on the webzine compared to the magazine. Yoshia has been doing some analyses, whether it's best to, get the articles up one day, put them down, keep articles up a little bit longer, how you deal with that whole issue. We're very pleased so far, but we're going to have to continue to make improvements and try to reach out. And I want to take this opportunity to invite listeners to send submissions to us. You can send submissions, 1,000-word articles is what we're looking for, basically, on any subject, but, from a generally radical perspective. You can send articles to Yoshia, Y-O-S-H-I-E, at monthlyreview, one word, .org. that would be the best way to do it. So I want to encourage listeners to submit things.
And I should say that I asked Yoshi to come on the show to talk about the Enterprise, but she demurred. Thought her accent was too thick or something. But
They thought, I don't know. Maybe they thought I had a better radio voice. I don't know.
Anyway, I urge the listeners to check out mrzine.org check out the whole. If you're not familiar with the what comes from Monthly Review, the magazine, and the publishing house, please do check it out. It's some really important, very good stuff there, and all highly readable. But now let's talk a little bit about what you've been up to lately. You took early retirement several years ago after teaching economics for many, many years Pitt, University of Pittsburgh?
Yes, at Pittsburgh.
Johnstown campus?
Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
You took early retirement and have been pretty much on the road, traveling around the United States ever since. First of all, why the early retirement? Stanley Aronowitz says being a college professor is the last good job in America. You didn't find it quite that?
Well, actually, I have I have a series on work on the webzine, and the second piece in the series is about college teaching. Actually, it's becoming a less and less attractive job as it's the province of more and more part timers, and more colleges are run on a business model, students pick up on that and are less attracted to study or learn anything or what have you. And I got just sort of disgusted with the whole – well, I just got disgusted with the job. I got really burned out. I taught for 32 years there, and that was a pretty long time. And the school, to me, kept getting worse and worse, and the students worse and worse. And so I was fortunate that I taught for so long, and the stock market boomed in the late 90s. My pension got big enough so that I could consider – retiring. There were some financial downsides to it, but it seemed like the smartest thing to do for my sanity.
And so you're in Flagstaff. You what?
That's what I did.
Okay, you're in Flagstaff, Arizona now, right?
Right. And yeah, when I retired in 2001, the first thing we did was we worked in Yellowstone National Park at a hotel. We lived there for 4 months, and that was quite interesting. I kept a journal of my stay there and what it was like to. I worked behind a desk as a hotel clerk. That was interesting. And then after that, we were going to move to Manhattan, and 9/11 occurred, so we were delayed by a couple of months. We lived in Manhattan for a year, where I worked at the Monthly Review office. Then after that, we moved around a little bit and ended up in Portland, Oregon. We lived for 14 months there, and then we were on the road for 150 days last year. Moved to Miami Beach for 7 months, and we've been on the road since May 1st again. And in September, we're going to be living in a little town, Estes Park, Colorado, which is right next to Rocky Mountain National Park. So that's our next sort of semi-permanent stay.
So I'm curious of your impressions of these various places. First of all, New York City, quite a change from Pennsylvania, and not much like the rest of the United States. What do you make of it?
Well, I would say this about New York City. If you're going to live in a city, and it's a shame it's so expensive, because that's really the only city I could imagine living in. The rest of the cities in the country, for the most part, and there are some exceptions, but they just leave a lot to be desired. And, the highway system has truncated these cities and messed them all up, and there's just pollution, and the downtowns are a mess. And New York City is really, to me, it was a real livable city. Wouldn't have been pretty expensive of it. I mean, there's pollution there like there is in every city, but generally speaking, nothing but good things to say about Manhattan. I think that's a pretty good city. It's a lot better to live there than in Pittsburgh or Portland, Oregon, or
Portland,
New Mexico, you name it.
You were not impressed with Portland. A lot of people think it's a wonderful combination of livability and urbanity, but you don't think so. What was your problem with Portland?
What I thought about Portland, what disappointed me the most, is of all the cities I lived in, Portland has the most potential. They've done a lot of good things there. It's a reasonably green city. There's lots of nice parks, and they have a big a green zone that blocks off the suburbs. And there's miles and miles of hiking trails you can reach by foot right from the city. It's a bicycle-friendly city. They got the best, what I think is the best farmers market in the country. It's even better than the one in Union Square, which is a pretty good one in my opinion. We went there and made some contacts with fishermen and farmers and so on. So we ate real well while we were there. It's a real walkable city. The main problem that I found there, though, was that the racial composition is terrible. It's one person, a writer said it was the last bastion of Caucasian culture in the urban Caucasian culture in the United States, and I think that's really true. I mean, there's so little diversity, and Oregon has a long and ugly history of racism, sort of almost like a southern state.
Yeah, the Klan was active there in the 20s, wasn't it?
Exactly, and you know, black people came in to engage in shipbuilding and so on during after the First World War. I think they were placed in a floodplain. Their whole community was wiped out by a flood in the Columbia River. Then they were pushed into a bunch of different isolated sort of urban areas, and they were urban renewed out of existence. And when I was there, I mean, geez, I don't know how many incidences there were of police shooting black people, and really real shaky and ugly situations where that didn't really need to happen. And the townspeople seemed to. Well, there was a black basketball player there named Rasheed Wallace, for example, and he made some statements about racism in the basketball league, and he wouldn't talk to reporters. Well, geez, I mean, I'm telling you, the press crucified the guy, and it was on the talk shows all the time. It was just, I mean, I met the guy's mother at a basketball game, really nice person. He's a pretty good person, too. Does a lot of good work in the community, but the people just couldn't get over these comments that he made. I mean, racism seemed to be on the, you know, the issue of race, is, even though there's hardly any black people live there, it's just right on everybody's tongue, so to speak. So that was one big problem. And the second big problem was the employment situation there. It's just absolutely dreadful. I mean, low wages and housing's expensive. So, I mean, it's like there was so much economic inequality and that race issue was so big that it sort of, for me, it countered the good aspects of the town.
And then,
so I'm not going to say there's not a lot of good things there. And they're real progressive about food issues and gay. There's a lot of gay people there that don't face nearly as much overt discrimination as they would face in other places. So, you know, there are a lot of progressive things about Portland, but there are a lot of regressive things, too. And the labor situation there was a bad one, I thought.
I'm speaking with Michael Yates, Associate Editor of Monthly Review Magazine, and a political economist on the road. You also spent some time in Miami. What were your impressions of that place?
Well, we were in Miami Beach, and I'll tell you what. I mean, one of the things we noticed as we traveled across country, and over the last 4 years even, and I've been across country several times before, and that is that there really seems to be a palpable increase in inequality in the country. You see this in all kinds of ways. You know, you see it in housing, where there's more and more really expensive, lavish, elaborate housing, and then there, you know, we encountered lots of people living in motels and lots of ugly housing, and you know, you can almost feel it, like in the streets. You can feel a sense of unease generated by this increase in inequality. But geez, you know, on one hand, in Miami Beach, we were living right on the ocean, and you know, you'd see poor people bathing in the ocean. At the same time, that you have rock stars and so on having these lavish private parties in these hotels, complete with these enormous structures built on public beaches. Overnight, they're put up with industrial-sized air conditioners, big tents, you know. And somebody like Gloria Estefan and her husband will have this lavish party, you know, just unbelievable. Or you'll have some rock star having a party with wild animals. So they had this one where they had penguins, and another one where they had cheetahs and, you know, exotic animals. The Miami Heat basketball team had this lavish party on the beach where they built another one of these structures. They had elephants, camels, giraffes. Then when they tear these things down, the beach is completely trashed. You know, junk and trash and garbage all over the place, which they seldom clean up. You go two blocks back from the beach. It's dangerous to walk the streets at night in Miami Beach. The bars are open till 5 a.m. I pitied the poor waiters that got out of work and had to carry cash home because there's all kind of robberies and holdups. And so it's like a real city of just excess and extremes, it seemed to me. A place where really rich people come and hang out for a while and then leave. The housing market is insane. People lining up on the streets blocks long to buy new condos. Condos flipping twice before anybody even lives in them. Hotel rooms for sale. More and more hotels are being converted into condo hotels. $800,000 for a hotel room. So I guess my main impression of Miami Beach was is that it has one of the prettiest beaches in Florida. But it's hard to appreciate that beach because it's so trashed and there's just so much excess that goes along with it. So If there's ever a place of excess, Miami Beach is it for sure.
Yeah, well, the place was founded practically in a speculative land mania, and they've continued that tradition ever since.
Well, sure. I've been, the whole state of Florida was built on gigantic hype and advertising. I've read a lot about it, but you know, when you see a city like Miami just sprawling out towards the Everglades, you know, ruining one of the most important natural things there, the Everglades, the water supplies messed up, the land's polluted. Really, in Little Havana, in the city of Miami, they had these gorgeous, gigantic, big trees. I forget what kind of trees they were, and they wanted to build this walkway, the town fathers, and so to speak, and they just were chopping down all these gigantic, big trees. Finally, the neighbors protested, and they decided not to do it. But Florida's a place where there used to be a lot of natural beauty, but it's long gone.
Yeah, they've done their best to cover it over with unnatural ugliness, haven't they?
Exactly. And that's what you see across the country. I mean, you take a city like Albuquerque, New Mexico, you enter the city, the next 19 exits for Albuquerque. I've never seen a city with 19 exits. You see pretty clearly why, because it's all sprawled out. Just giant, goes on and on and on, suburbs and exurbs. You can't get around unless you have a car. You have to exit hop. And, of course, then what's the solution to the problem? You got to build more highways. Bring more cars, more people in there. The population, I think, in Albuquerque 40, 50 years ago was about 200,000. Now it's 800,000, rapidly approaching a million. It's just a hot, dry place. It's not fit for 800,000 people.
Yeah, well, that whole part of the world is just not fit to house millions and millions of people.
What you find is that the natural beauty that's here just disappears pretty quickly. Right outside of Albuquerque, there's the Petroglyph National Monument, where there are these ancient petroglyphs. Well, first of all, they've all been graffitied over. So you're looking for a petroglyph, and you see a smiley face, or you see Joe was here, or you see some profanity, and now they want to build a highway through it. It's just like sort of incredible. Almost has to be seen to be believed.
Yeah, I was struck with this some years ago when I was in Oregon, and just near the coast. Well, the Oregon, just coming off the coast, and the Oregon coast, one of the most beautiful places on earth, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
And then like a mile inland, there was a convenience store that was made out of corrugated aluminum. It was the most hideous thing that was just thrown up in a, you know, and they're selling the usual things they sell in convenience stores. But how people could build something that hideous so close to something of such stunning natural beauty, it makes me wonder what kind of consciousness has been formed that can do things like that.
Well, I think it's a sense of alienation. You know, it's an alienation from one another, an alienation from nature. I mean, the one place where we find friendly people is when we're hiking on trails. People are happy then because the air is clean and they're getting exercise and they're feeling good about themselves. And you get into some real nice conversations with people on the trails. But a lot of times, if you're in cities or on, you know, sidewalks in towns and stuff, you know, people can't even look up and say hello to you. And it's just amazing. And then you see, like, even in small towns, you're talking about the Oregon coast. There's a neat little town in south central Oregon called Florence, and there's Florence is the beginning of 50 miles of sand dunes south along the Oregon coast. It's one of the few places where you don't get them. In the Oregon coast, you mostly get mountains that come right down to the ocean, but there's a place where you don't. You can walk for 10, 20 miles on the beach and not see another person every day. And in this little town of Florence, which used to be a little fishing town, well, the first thing they did, they put a casino up now. So they got a casino in Florence. And that'll probably spell disaster for the town. It hasn't yet, but it probably will. And the second thing you notice, in this tiny little town, there aren't 20,000 people living in the whole area. You got gated communities. Yeah, I mean, you just wonder, like,
who are they trying to keep out?
Well, that's exactly right. In 29 Palms, California, this dismal little town in the desert, you get a gated community. Right, exactly. Who are they trying to keep out?
And maybe it just makes the residents feel important.
I suppose.
Well, in these travels, I mean, given this description of incredible polarization between rich and poor that you see, the ravaging of the landscape, this extremely dysfunctional sprawl structure which characterizes most of our cities now, do you engage people in political conversations? What kind of consciousness do you come across politically?
Well, yeah, you do. I do whenever I can. If you talk to working people about their work, of course you get a sense of alienation. You know, they're not very happy.
But Americans always tell pollsters they're very happy.
course, in the South and the Southwest, you know, it's sometimes a little bit difficult to engage a lot of workers unless you speak Spanish, because, you know, they're the workers that do the day-to-day drudge work in all these places are almost always people of color. And there's tens and tens of thousands of motel cleaners and landscape groundskeepers and repair people and stuff like that. And, you know, they're all people of color. Now, if they're happy about their work, I'd really be surprised. I mean, a lot of the women have to bring their kids to work. You know, women look after each other's kids. They bring their kids to work. They sometimes swim in the motel pool and stuff like that, or they're riding in the laundry carts. And, you know, it's hard to engage these people in conversation because a lot of them are afraid anyway. My suspicion is a lot of them don't have documentation, and so, you know, they're nervous. They don't like to talk too much. So it's hard to engage people like that. But, you know, you do engage people, and it's not long before, you know, I remember we were hiking in Estes Park, Colorado, met a nurse, and, you know, not very long before people start talking about family troubles, about troubles on their job and stuff like that. So you can engage people. It's not easy to do. One of the things I found out here in the West is that there's a big attraction to churches and religion. There's all these mega churches out here, for one thing. Colorado's a big center. Where's the Air Force Academy?
Colorado Springs.
Colorado Springs. Oh, my gosh. That's the center for mega churches and fundamentalist Christianity. These people are a mixed bag, you know what I mean? They have, on the one hand, they're a lot of times when you meet them and you talk to them, they're kind people. And they're friendly people. I just think that the modern world and, you know, I attribute a lot of it to that there's no organized labor to keep people's thoughts along a little bit more progressive path.
Yeah, well, the only vocabulary people have to express their discontent or even any kind of solidarity is around fundamentalist religion.
No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think sometimes progressives downplay that, but boy, you sure see it everywhere. I mean, I don't, you know, like I say, you meet people on the trails and you see some Christian symbol on their hat or something, and you know that they're probably fundamentalist Christians, and you engage them in conversation. I have to be careful, my wife and I have to be careful we don't swear. You know, you're from the East or you lived in New York City, I mean, you know, profanity is no big deal, but
that's what we say.
Here,
hello.
You know,
it's how we say hello, how are you? In
right, sometimes, you know, it is, and my tendency is to, you know, I might use a profane word or as a regular part of my conversation, you have to be a little bit careful about that because, you know, I don't really want to offend anybody. And you engage people in conversation, and you know, they're nice and they're friendly. But on the other hand, they're seeing the world through this sort of lens of fundamentalist Christianity. Makes you nervous. I mean, I don't know how much you could draw those people out. I haven't tried real hard. When we're settled in Estes Park, if I meet some people, maybe I will try to draw them out a little bit and see what they think about the war in Iraq. And I mean, you see a lot of discontent with that war if you read local papers, especially if there are any alternative papers anywhere. I know you've been talking there's been discussion, I know, on your LBO list about media sometimes. And I just want to tell you the state of media in small towns, I'm sure it's always been, but it is just so dreadful. I mean, no wonder people don't know anything. I mean, international news in the Flagstaff newspaper, I was in Joplin, Missouri, in the Joplin, Missouri newspaper, the international news is about 2 inches by 2 inches on the back page.
Yeah, and people who
the
do.
The local radio and the local TV, all dreadful. Everybody's smiling all the time on these news shows. They're smiling and, you know, they'll say 14 dead Marines in Iraq, and then they'll smile and they'll have some bit of trivia about some movie star or some silly local event or something. So, you know, the only good newspaper in the country is the New York Times, in my opinion.
Yeah, people
as
do.
Major papers goes. Nothing compares to it. And local papers are just so bad, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, people who do media criticism just focus on the big stuff and don't really look at a lot of the little outlets that people get a lot of their news from.
Well, they get their news from local radio. They get their news from these local papers. And these local papers are just, they're worse than you could possibly imagine, unless you've ever read them.
Well, I've read some. I don't need to do the imagining. But we are out of time, and I'd like to thank you for joining us. And I'd like to have you check in after you've done a little more traveling and hear some more of your reports.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you for joining us, Michael Yates. Michael Yates is author of several books on labor, published by Monthly Review Press, and associate editor of Monthly Review Magazine. And check out MR's webzine at mrzine.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with a little bit of Allen Ginsberg in America. I'll be away the next couple of weeks, but I'll be here on recording. Next week, we'll have David Roediger talking about how white ethnics became white. Very interesting process of whitening. And I recorded that interview earlier today, and very fascinating stuff. Very good book of his, just out from Basic Books. So stay tuned for the news. I'll be back in person in a few weeks. Bye.
America, how can I write a holy litany in your silly mood? I will continue, like Henry Ford. My strophes are as individual as his automobiles. More so, they're all different sexes. America, I will sell you strophes, 2,500 apiece, 500 down on your old strophe. America, free Tom Mooney. America, save the Spanish loyalists. America, Sacco and Vanzetti must not die. I am the Scottsboro Boys. America, when I was 7, Mama took me to communist cell meetings. They sold us garbanzos, a handful per ticket. A ticket cost a nickel, and the speeches were free. Everybody was angelic and sentimental about the workers. It was all so sincere, you have no idea what a good thing the party was. In 1835, Scott Nearing was a grand old man, a real mensch. Mother Bloor made me cry. I once saw Israel Amter plane. Everybody must have been a spy. America, you don't really want to go to war. America, it's them bad Russians. Them Russians, and them Chinamen, and them Russians. The Russia wants to eat us alive. The Russia's power mad. She wants to take our cars from out our garages. Her wants to grab Chicago. Her needs Red Readers' digests. Her wants our auto plants in Siberia. Him big bureaucracy running our filling stations. That no good.